Hi, this is James Devine, and I am an educator who has come out of the trenches. Listen in as my friend and colleague Dana Goodyear shares stories and tips from other educators who have come out of the trenches.
Welcome to the Out of the Trenches podcast. This is Dana Goodyear. Thanks for listening. My next guest is Melissa Lowry. She is a sought-after education and parenting coach with over 20 years' experience as a teacher, curriculum director, and school principal. She is the founder of Melissa Lowry Education Coaching, a consulting firm that provides distance virtual learning coaching services for students in grades K-12, organizes and manages home learning plans, works with students to develop strong executive functioning skills, and helps parents and educators build and maintain strong homeschool relationships. Melissa is the author of Answer Keys, Teacher Lesson Plans for Successful Parenting. Her work has been featured in print, on the web, and on the airwaves. Welcome to the podcast, Melissa.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Well, tell me about a time when you were in the trenches and managed to crawl out.
Oh, gosh. I think that there are probably several different times in my life I've had to sort of either reinvent or, I wouldn't say change who I am, but kind of change my strategy, even within the field of education, which I've been doing for so long. But I would say that probably it was when I changed careers and became a teacher. And after college, I had majored in communication, and I'd gone into the field of advertising, and I was kind of going up that ladder, and I was in my early 20s, and I thought, this is fantastic. And then I go into work one day and I get laid off, and it was just that gut punch. And I remember just thinking to myself, like, what am I going to do now? And it wasn't this automatic thought of I wanted to stay in advertising. And so I just went home and I really thought about it, and I really looked at my skill set and the things I was interested in, and I kind of went to bed without an answer and woke up the next morning, and it was, you need to go into teaching. And it was just this strange sort of, yes, that's exactly what I need to do. And then it was pulling myself up. I didn't have the education. I had to apply to go to school. I had to put my tail between my legs and move back in with my parents for a while because I wasn't really making any money. And it was a really humbling experience to all of a sudden, you went to college for something specific, you thought you were in this field that you wanted to pursue forever. And then all of a sudden the trajectory, it changes. And then the path changes, and just sort of having to pivot with that and feeling pretty, you know, low and down about myself that I'd been laid off from a job that I thought I'd been good at, and having to take some criticism for kind of, maybe I wasn't as good as I thought I was. And just really having to do some soul searching about who I wanted to be and what I wanted to accomplish in my life. And it was difficult. And then it was pounding the pavement, and I didn't get the first teaching job I interviewed for, and I didn't get the second teaching job I interviewed for. And it was like the third or fourth that I finally got. And then it was going back to grad school again, and it just reinventing yourself and starting over. And that was a really tough time, but it was also what led to the very, I would say, fulfilling career that I have now.
And kind of tell me a little bit about your work, kind of where you are now and what led you to your current position.
Sure. Well, that's almost another out of the trenches story in and of itself. But for the past 8 years, I've been working at a school here in Atlanta, and I had started out in a teaching position in middle school language arts. And then I moved into the curriculum director role, and I'd been in that role for a couple of years when things that were happening in administration just, I wasn't seeing eye to eye with what the philosophy was. And I decided that even after 7 years in this environment, it wasn't healthy for me to be there anymore. And so I quit. I finished out my contract. I chose not to renew it. And that was right in the middle of a pandemic. And it was like, I had this very stable job, and I just said, I can't do this anymore. And so I had to, again, pivot really quickly and figure out what to do. And that's when I decided to go into distance learning. I was getting tons of phone calls from people I knew, just seeking advice and asking what they could do with their own kids. And I had been running this virtual curriculum when everyone got sent into quarantine and the shelter in place orders. And I thought, okay, I can do this. And so I opened a micro school in the basement of my house, and I had seven students in grades 5, 6, and 7. and I was managing their remote learning plans. They were all public school students. And it was, again, it was a huge shift, a huge change, lots of self-doubt. I wasn't sure if I could do this. And then, are people going to want to come to my house? Are they going to want to send their kids to me? And I was, mm-hmm. I was pleasantly surprised with the reception that my little school and what I was doing, kind of the reception I received. And then from that, I started doing SSAT prep, which is a high school entrance exam prep, high school entrance exam, the SSAT. And you can, I think kids take it starting going into like rising fourth grade or so, and then up through high school. And then I also started working with families that were choosing to homeschool, and I was helping them implement homeschooling curriculum as well. And so I started doing that, I would say, in early August of 2019, or was it 2020? For the last, you know what, the years are going into each other, but
it would have been 20.
It was 2020. So last August, and it just went gangbusters. And I had more kind of more inquiries than I could fulfill on my own. And it was a really fun thing to do, and very different than what I'd been doing in a school environment every single day. And working with these children was so fulfilling. And I'm still in touch with all of them now. They're all back in school. But it was just such a gift for me to be able to kind of slow down and take that time and have that little school in my basement. And it's just lovely.
Yeah, it looks like you kind of took that opportunity, since you've been working on digital learning curricula before the pandemic, and you took the opportunity and supported those students when they really needed it. So, you know, that you have that niche, right? You kind of ran with it.
I did. And I thought, you know, I mean, what better time than a pandemic to just, you know, quit your full-time job and start out on your own. I'm sure there's nobody who said, you know what, that's a fabulous idea. But I have to say, my husband was so incredibly supportive. He knew I wasn't happy that I'd been working 60, 70 hours a week, doing these remote learning plans for this school, and that it was really taking its toll on me. And he's like, you've got to do something different. So if not for his encouragement, I don't know that I would have made the leap that I did, but I'm really glad that I took that leap.
And you talked a little bit about the test prep and the SSAT and other standardized tests. So, you know, in the fall, a lot of students have, you know, their SAT, the ACT, and other college entrance exams. So how can listeners who are both educators supporting their students, but also who are parents supporting their own children, support this students as they prepare to take these entrance exams?
Well, I don't want to speak as much to the SAT and the ACT because the test prep that I focus on is with younger students. So I'm really focusing on the admissions process into high school, let's say, as opposed to the admissions process into college, which now that I've got a rising junior, maybe in a couple years, once I've figured out what she needs to do, you and I can chat about that again. But in the meantime, what I would say is, I mean, if a family is looking, let's say, to leave the public school and go into a private school, they would need to take one of a couple of different types of standardized tests. It depends on the school. But the one that I was preparing for is called the SSAT. And basically, it's looking at an area of language arts, an area of sort of logic and reason, and then reading comprehension and math. And what I would say for people is to really sit down and think about who your child is and how your child would react to different preparation types of situations. So if you've got a child that's really introverted and a child that really is very cerebral, you may not want to consider a group environment. If you've got a child that's outgoing and kind of thrives in that kind of school-like environment, then I would say that a group type of preparation would be something that would work really, really well. I think that it is important for students to connect with whoever it is that they're working with if they're doing a one-on-one or small group. That doesn't mean that your child has to love the person he or she's working with, but there does have to be some sort of connection, because otherwise the child's not going to be as motivated to be actively involved in that process of test prep. But what I would say to parents, and this is probably not going to be a very, I don't know if it's not that it's going to be a popular response, but if parents have to think about who their child is, and if their child has to engage in so much test prep, to simply get into position to be able to get into a school, I think that should cause a parent to pause a little bit of whether or not it's the right environment. And I have said that to parents, like, if you are spending thousands and thousands of dollars just to prepare your child to take a middle school entrance exam or high school, you have to say, is this going to be the right high school? Because am I now inviting four more years of tutors and all of these things because the rigor or the standard at this particular school might not fit my child? And each child is different. Some kids test really well, some don't. Some are very into school at this point. Others aren't going to reach their peak for quite a long time. Like for me, I probably didn't achieve at a standard that was that high until I got to grad school and found that what I really, really wanted to do. And so I think sometimes parents get so obsessed with that test prep that they don't actually think about the years that are going to follow that once your child gets into that school environment. And so that is actually something really that people need to consider while they're having their child prepare for that process is, do we want our kid to be that stressed out all the time? Is our child going to be that stressed out if he or she gets into that environment? And then the other is to space it out over time, because children feel pressure. And when their parents have got their thumb on them and they're trying to cram all this information in their head to take the standardized test, it usually doesn't work out well unless the child's had adequate amount of time to prepare.
Okay. Yeah. I think those are great points, because we see, you know, some of these kids that are pushed, and then, you know, they eventually get to med school and then they realize, hey, that's not what I really want to do. Right. So.
Yes. Or they're sustained on tutors. And I've said that people ask me about tutoring all the time. Like, when does my child need a tutor? What type of tutor? And what I usually like to say is, if your child requires a consistent level of support for an extended period of time, your child's probably not developmentally ready for that material. Tutoring should be specific, it should be targeted, and it should really last for a short period of time. And this is different than children with learning differences or dyslexia. I'm not talking about that child. I'm just saying, if your child's struggling with algebra 2, for instance, and you want to bring in a tutor, that's great. But if your child's going to require a tutor through that class for the entire year, what's going to happen the following year when he or she goes to pre-calc or trig or whatever it is? Math is an interesting animal, because it's not just the skills. There are concepts that children need to be developmentally ready for. And that's why in middle school, you'll have students who are really ready for algebra in eighth grade, and you'll have kids that are really not ready for algebra until high school. And that doesn't mean that one student is smarter than the other at all. It just means that developmentally they're in different places. And the sort of the metaphor or what I use to explain that is, when children learn to walk, we can prep our kids to learn to walk, but they're going to walk when they walk. And if you have multiple kids like I do, they did not walk on the same day at 9 months or 10 months. I think my son may have walked at 14 and my daughter at 15, but they're now both running. It doesn't mean that one of them was smarter than the other or even more athletic. It's just, it clicked at a different time. And so I do say that with tutoring, that if your child isn't able to make it through without a tutor for an extended period of time, that's time for mom and dad to go, wait a second. It might not be the right time for my child to be taking on this subject matter for whatever reason. And that's perfectly okay. And to kind of go back to that material later, but you're just inviting years and years and years of tutoring and tutoring and tutoring just to keep up, if you don't recognize where your child sort of might be developmentally.
Yeah, I think that's interesting. I do some freelance tutoring myself, and you know, you're talking about those schools that have admissions. So I'm working twice a week with a student in Germany who's going to an immersion magnet school in the fall. And you know, the parents are wanting her to be tutored in German, even though her level of German is already pretty high, just so she would be even more prepared for that magnet school. And I think, you know, there are also a lot of you know, parents that use kind of tutoring as that, like you say, that springboard right into maybe a different school they're going to go to, or to be better prepared than they think their child already is. So you think tutoring is beneficial in that way, when they're maybe entering a school and the parent is unsure if their child's at that level?
And then I think absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. I think that, and we do this at the school, actually, since you and I last talked, mm-hmm. I actually went back into a school and I'm acting as the school principal. And mm-hmm. I would say that when we're looking at our admissions process, we will look at the tests that the kids take when they come in. And we don't actually, at the school I'm at, use a standardized exam. We wrote our own exams, mm-hmm. but we'll look at where the students are. And if we think that they might not be able to take on a little bit of the rigor, we might recommend very targeted, very specific mm-hmm. tutoring for a period of time to get the child where he or she needs to be. Mm-hmm. So there is a time and place for tutoring. I'm a huge fan, especially mm-hmm. in the areas of executive function. Yeah. But again, I think that if your child is struggling so mightily in a subject area, and even with a tutor is having to put forth such a significant amount of effort, chances are it's not the right place for your child at that time. That doesn't mean it's mm-hmm. never going to be the right place, but it's not the right place developmentally right now.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, I get that, because you know those kids, like some of those algebra classes, and you know there's only so much tutoring you can do before, you know, we got to see there's not any growth, right? And that, you know, they just have to kind of move on. So I wanted to then talk a little bit about executive functioning, since you've mentioned that, and the soft skills, the growth mindset, and some of the PD that you've done on executive functioning for both parents and educators.
Right. So I definitely do a lot of tutoring with executive function, but that's, mm-hmm. it's, I hate to kind of call it tutoring, because mm-hmm, executive mm-hmm. function is really just a fancy way of saying sort of like life skills, or kind of how to keep your bleep together sort of skills. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, it's mm-hmm. how you can kind of walk through and function in life. And so that's not really something you quote unquote tutor, but what I think you can do is create situations for students that help them to build those mm-hmm. skills. So for instance, I've been working with a high schooler, and she left a private school environment to go to public school during a pandemic. Mm-hmm. So she went from a school where they were doing in-person learning to a school where they were largely virtual. Mm-hmm. And so all of a sudden she had to change how she was approaching this material. And this is a student with ADHD and dyslexia. Mm. So she had kind of a whole host of things going on. And it was, how do we help her kind of pivot away from one type of learning, take on another type, and then develop the skills to be successful? And so mm-hmm. each week we would meet and we would work on different strategies that she would then try and implement during that week. And then when we met the next week, I would say, okay, what went right? What went wrong? Whatever went right, how do we replicate it again? Whatever mm-hmm. went wrong, how do we change it? And those were kind of the questions with executive function that I'm always challenging my students with. Mm-hmm. What's going right? What's going wrong? What do we replicate? And what do we change? Because I know it works for me. Like, I have to have a paper calendar, but many people like to have, you know, their Outlook calendar. Mm-hmm. I can't force someone to use a paper calendar if that's not going to work for that person. And so with executive function, a lot of people will say, well, just do this, do this, do this, do this. Well, if the child doesn't learn that way, or doesn't respond to that type of tutoring or instruction, or mm-hmm. the skill set you're trying to teach, they're not going to implement it. They're not going to use the strategies. And so when I work with a student, I'm presenting different strategies each week. So for instance, this child's a visual learner. So what we started doing was printing out a monthly calendar, and then everything that we could take off of Google Classroom and that she could put on a monthly calendar, it allowed her to visualize it. As a dyslexic, she was thinking in pictures. And so for her to be able to take that mental snapshot really worked. And then each week we would do a list by day of what it was that she needed to do that week. And it would be everything. Like, I'm going to get my hair cut. I have a lacrosse match. So she could start to visualize what her calendar looked like, so she could start to organize herself. And so the idea was to present her with enough strategies where she could pick and choose, like a kind of like a cafeteria line, pick and choose what worked. And then for me to give her opportunities to practice those skills. And then when she made mistakes, for me to help her pivot, what went wrong, what do we change, those types of questioning, so that she started to engage in metacognition, which is, it's just a fancy way of saying thinking about thinking. How do you approach this problem? How do you approach your schedule? What's working? What's not? And really just guiding her. A lot of open-ended questions, as opposed to me saying, you have to do this, you have to do that. And I have found over the years of executive function, that's one of the best ways to help students be successful is to present them with a ton of different strategies and let them start to pick and choose what they like, what works for them, and then to practice it. And I would say, I think you and I touched on it earlier in a conversation, someone like a Peg Dawson, who's just an expert in this area, she authors the Smart But Scattered series. And I highly recommend it for any parent or educator out there that's looking for a place to start. And I have been to conferences that she's put on before. I definitely use a lot of her strategies as a cornerstone of what I do as a tutor. I definitely did not come up with this stuff on my own. And I would say that of all of the different programs I've looked at, and trust me, I'm not endorsing anything. Peg Dawson has no idea who I am. I just like her stuff. And that's what that has worked for me as a tutor. And I have felt like I can take a ton of her strategies, give them to kids, and they work in a variety of different places. So I think for the audience out there, that Smart But Scattered series is, it's great.
Yeah, I think those are so great to, you know, list as opportunities for working with our kids and, you know, just giving them those options and finding out how they react to those different learning styles. Because if they're in a class, you know, with 25 kids, a lot of the time, they're not going to have that one-on-one time where they actually find out what learning style is best in their executive functioning skill. So I think that's so important to break down for us. And then when parents are choosing a tutor, so what are things that they should look for in a tutor or like, you know, in terms of, I would say maybe progress after a couple of sessions and those type of things?
Well, I think that with a tutor, it's important for the child. Like every time I'm going to tutor a student, I tell the parents, I want to have an initial meeting with the child, kind of a meet and greet. I never charge for that. I'll usually go to their house or they would come to my house or we'd meet at Starbucks, you know, something like that, and have a conversation with the child and make sure that there's buy-in. I have found that pretty much any time a child's been completely and totally forced to work with me, it really doesn't work. Now, that doesn't mean the child has to want to be tutored. That's different. I mean, most kids are kind of kicking and screaming, but we have to have a basic connection and the child needs to understand why it is that I'm getting involved in the process. So that buy-in needs to be there. And then I would also say, obviously, subject matter mastery. Like I would never say, I want to go and tutor trigonometry. Like my master's degree is in literacy and language arts. I can tutor math up through probably pre-algebra, but I would never advertise myself as someone who tutors. Test prep is different. But so subject level math.
This podcast is a proud member of the Teach Better Podcast Network. Better today, better tomorrow, and the podcast to get you there. Explore more podcasts at www.teachbetterpodcastnetwork.com. Now let's get back to the episode.
Mastery, but then I also think goals. Any tutor should be able to sit down with a parent and say, okay, these are the actionables. I am going to do A, B, C, and D after I take a look and assess kind of where your child is. And I think in this number of sessions, it's reasonable to be able to say that I can close the gap. So with my last student, I said to the parents, it's going to be a semester. I'm going to start with her in January. And by the time she's done in May, this is what I think the outcome's going to be. And I just got the email from them the other day and she hit the goals that they were looking for. And I was like, then my work is done here. And I said, let's touch base in August to see how I can help her be set up. But then the idea is for her to be independent. She shouldn't have to have me as a tutor going longer. If I've done my job as an executive function tutor, I'm not working with a child longer than 6 months, maybe a year, depending on the student. But you don't want that child working with you for 2 years or you haven't achieved your goal. Yeah. And so I would say any good tutor is going to be able to say, hey, look, here's the gap in skills that I see. These are reasonable goals to set for your child. This is how I think your child can get from point A to point B. And then at the end of, let's say it's 2 months or 6 months, whatever it is, we can reassess and see whether or not we hit those goals. And if we didn't hit them, is something else happening? Like, are we seeing another deficit? Was there maybe an outside situation that took place or something that's influencing your child's achievement, whatever it might be? And then we would sort of reevaluate and then decide to move on. But any good tutor is not just going to say, oh yeah, you know, we'll just like tutor for, you know, 6 months or a year. The tutor should have actionable goals and a way to achieve those goals that's important. And then I also, and this again, probably some tutors out there won't like to hear, tutors shouldn't be charging an arm and a leg. Mm-hmm. I think we should be making enough money so that we do well, of course. But any tutor that's charging way too much and any tutor who's charging way too little, and that kind of depends on where you live and, you know, a tutoring rate mm-hmm. in New York City is going to be different than Atlanta, Georgia, mm-hmm. but it should be reasonable. And again, the tutor should be able to say, for this money, mm-hmm. this is what you're going to get from me. This is the benefit that your child's going to see mm-hmm. from working with me. And so those are the types of questions that a parent would probably need to ask. What are the actionables? Mm-hmm. How long do we think this is going to take? And what are reasonable goals for my child? How will you help my child achieve those goals?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think those are great points to bring forth when parents are looking for the tutors and, you know, those tutors are starting out with a new kid. And I like that meet and greet, right? Because like you're saying, there are students who come and their parents are dragging them, right? And then you want to make sure that you can set a goal, like you said, you're starting at the beginning of the semester, and then reevaluate if the tutoring needs to continue. But I like that piece of, you know, 3 to 6 months, maybe a year, depending on the subject matter. So yeah, those are great points. I wanted to talk to you a little bit about, so you've had experience both in the public school setting and then the private school setting. And what is your perspective about working in the private parochial school and kind of the funding that you need to get in the schools from somebody who's only worked in public schools? Talk a little bit about the benefits to parochial school and also how the funding works maybe in terms of, we're looking at Title I for public schools, but is there any funding that you can get?
So I would say almost all of my experience is in parochial school. And just for mm-hmm. people who might not know the difference, a parochial school is a Catholic school attached to a parish, to a church mm-hmm. itself. Mm-hmm. So you can have private schools, you can have private Catholic schools, but a parochial school is very, very specific. And it's not mm-hmm. even the same as a private religious school. So we actually are attached to a church. And the reason why that's important is it influences tuition. So mm-hmm. like our tuition that we would charge at a parochial school would be markedly lower than something you would see in a private school. That does mm-hmm. make a parochial school education for a lot of people a lot more affordable than a typical private school education would be. But then, you know, there are trade-offs where sometimes class size is larger. The school I happen to be at, our class size is still pretty good at about 20 mm-hmm. to 22. And some schools are, parochial schools are going to be a lot higher than that. I would say my experience with public school is more limited in the work that I've been doing with the students that are on remote learning. Mm-hmm. And I do have to say that I couldn't have been more impressed, at least here in Atlanta where I live, with the public schools that I was working with and the efforts that those teachers were putting in during remote and virtual learning. It was incredibly impressive. Mm-hmm. The school that I had been at actually went back in August and has had full in-person learning the whole time. We were pretty fortunate. But those public schools, it was really difficult. But those teachers, they were working really hard because I was watching mm-hmm. what they were doing every day. But as far as the funding, actually parochial and private schools have access to the same federal funding that the public schools have access to. Mm-hmm. So when you talk about Title I, for instance, if a parochial school is located within a Title I school district mm-hmm. where the local public school is offered Title I funding, that parochial and private school in that area also has to be offered Title I funding. And mm-hmm. so like Title I is free and reduced lunch. It's children living at or below the poverty line. Then you have Title II is all for professional development. Mm-hmm. Then you have Title III that works with immigrant families. You have Title IV that works with, they call it like innovative schools. So there are different funds for different titles and they provide funding for different areas of education. Mm-hmm. But parochial schools are going to have access to those funds, just like a public school would. We don't receive them in the same percentage, so we're not going to get the same amount of money. Mm-hmm, but mm-hmm. we personally, the school that I'm with, we work with APS, which is Atlanta Public Schools. Mm-hmm. And I have to put my hat off to them. They are amazing. And Atlanta Public Schools has made it very easy for the parochial school I work with to access our title funding. But that's kind of how that works. And so it subsidizes some of the programs that we offer. So if we have children who are on a free and reduced lunch program through Title I, we would be able to offer them a specific type of tutoring, and we pay those tutors out of the Title I funding. And so that's a little bit about how that works. Mm-hmm. Where the public schools, I'm not sure, I think once they're eligible for title funding, I think it just runs through their budget. Mm-hmm. For us, it runs a little bit differently, but we still have access to those funds.
Okay. Yeah, that's good to know, because, you know, like you were just pointing out, there are a lot of parochial schools that are in some of these lower income neighborhoods, and, you know, just knowing that they're able to access some of the, you know, the tutoring, the after school programs, and it's not having to come out of the general budget of the school.
Right. And it shouldn't. I know that there's always sort of this debate about whether or not private parochial, religious, whatever schools should receive any sort of federal funding. I totally understand that. Mm-hmm. But the federal funding that we receive, it doesn't take away dollars from, mm-hmm. I think that's a misnomer, from the public school system. So the way that it works with property taxes, at least here where we live, the children, a child in the public school is not going without, because a child in the parochial school is taking the funds that would have gone to the child in the public school. And mm-hmm. so I think sometimes people, politicians in particular, like to kind of pit the two sides against each other. And I like to say, we are all working toward the same goal. And so again, we work very closely with our local public school district, again, Atlanta Public Schools, to make sure that we're doing right by every single child, mm-hmm. regardless of whether or not that child attends a public school or a parochial school or a private mm-hmm. school. And I love that we have that partnership with our public school district here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's important to remember. You're all working towards the same goal, right?
Yeah, we are. Yes.
I wanted to talk to you about one more topic in terms of you do a little bit of parent coaching and talking to parents about the developmental ages / stages and building a literacy rich home. So tell me a little bit about some of those tips that you give to parents, especially when maybe they have several children who are different age groups, and maybe one child wasn't so great a reader and then another child is a better reader and those type of things.
Right. Well, I would say if you've got some parents out there and their children are still small, so we're mm-hmm. talking like toddler age and below, mm-hmm. I can't say it enough. Do not put technology in front of them. Mm-hmm. Just hold off as long as you can. Mm-hmm. It's one of those things where, hold on, I think I lost my video here for a second. Oh, there we go. So with the toddlers and below, what I would say is, and I'm not actually even really talking about television per se, I'm talking more about exposure to iPads, iPhones, mm-hmm. and what people would consider to be academic games.
Yeah.
That's an oxymoron. There's not an academic mm-hmm. game. And what we are seeing, and I by no means am like a neurologist or any of that, but what I can say is in 20 plus years of doing this, what happens with some of the technology with this instant gratification is that kids lose their patience level because they're constantly mm-hmm. having the mm-hmm. answer to something. They're pushing a button, there's a bright light, there's something going off, and they're not getting some of that soft skills training at a young age that they should be getting. So mm-hmm. I would say keep technology sort of away as long as you can. Once your kids get to that age where they're having a little bit of access to technology, I would say that you need to have really good rules in place for mm-hmm. when they access technology and how long they're accessing it. Because what's happening that we're seeing in the school system is the technology is actually replacing reading, because mm-hmm. it is faster and fancier than reading. And when our kids are young and they're being influenced by that technology and they're not building up that patience muscle, they are not able to then sustain attention when they are reading. So that's sort of an important mm-hmm. piece. I would say if you're developing a literacy-rich home, something that's very important is to make print available and to have your kids watching you read as well. And you want to have books and newspapers and magazines and all of those things around. It's less important what they're reading and more mm-hmm. important that they're getting their hands on things. And case in point, I'll have parents ask me all the time, oh, all my kid wants to do is read a graphic novel or a comic or things of that nature. It's not quality. And I'm like, oh, no. It's still building literacy. Those things can be just as important. And I would also say, if you have reluctant readers, books on tape. Audiobooks are phenomenal. And people will say, well, that's cheating. They're not really reading. And I would say, well, that's not necessarily true. We would like to see the kids read along with the book. That's what I always say. And one of my children's dyslexic. And so he downloads the books. And as he reads, he listens to them. That helps him build his literacy skills as he goes. And so I'm a huge fan of books on tape and audiobooks. And when you can follow along with the book, that's great. But even if kids are listening to those books, they are still being exposed to great literature. And they're still developing literacy skills as they listen. So I don't like to hear that people say, oh, it's just cheating if you're listening to an audiobook. You're still listening to Crime and Punishment, or you're still listening to some rich literature. It's just you're getting it in a slightly different form.
Yeah, and I've heard that from my child's teachers. You know, she's going into sixth grade now, but it was in fifth grade she finally liked reading more. But up until fifth grade, you know, a real struggle. And they would always say, you know, have her listen to the book, right? And it was kind of hard for me to understand, like, oh, well, if she's not actually reading it. But like, yeah, now that I have seen, like, and there is kind of that hump to get over and, you know, really enjoy reading. And like you're saying, I also agree with that part with the toddlers and below, like, you know, you see too many of them in the restaurants with the iPads. And, you know, it's that instant gratification. Like you said, we, you need to get kids, you know, like my kids who, you know, going into first, sixth and eighth grade, they're, you know, they need to do things before they can get that reward, right? But they're definitely, you know, I try to push the literacy piece, making sure that, you know, they have something in front of them. Like you said, I kind of felt like those comics or graphic novels don't really count, but, you know, they are still, you know, reading something, right? They're forming, listening and reading the story. So yeah.
Really, oh, absolutely. And I would say magazines too. Magazines are highly underrated. One of my children is a competitive skateboarder. And so he gets his skateboarding magazine, and I've never seen a child read so much in his life when he gets his magazine. And most magazines and newspapers are going to be written at sort of an early high school, like eighth to ninth grade level for the most part. And so when your children are younger, exposure to that type of print media is really, really, really great. And so again, any reading is going to be great in the beginning. And the other thing I would say to parents is they're going to hear from their kids, oh, I don't like that book. The kid will get a couple pages into it or a chapter into it. And they'll say it's boring. It doesn't sustain my attention. And what I say is to go back to it. And what I have found with my students, even when I was teaching middle school language arts, I take them like outside or somewhere where they could get into it. And I'd say, we are reading for a half an hour. So you're not leaving, you're not moving, you're not going anywhere else. You're reading for a half an hour. And what I found is once they got the wiggles out after a good 5 to 10 minutes where it would take them to settle themselves down. They would get lost in these books. But because of our instant gratification society, the kids aren't, they don't want to make that investment to spend 5, 10, 15 minutes trying to get into a book. They just want to throw it off if they're not totally engrossed right from the get-go. And I always say, nope, you've got to build up to it. You've got to spend a good 5, 10, 15 minutes. And then I find that a lot of my students, even the reluctant readers, they will fall into a book. But it can take somewhere between 5 and 15 minutes to get those wiggles out and to really kind of calm down enough to enjoy the book.
And that kind of reminds me of a lot of middle schools, at least in the Denver area, use the DEAR, the drop everything and read, right? Like once or twice a week. And it's usually for around 40 minutes. And, you know, there are students that, you know, they're just like, oh, I don't like the book or And then once you've gone past that 5 or 10 minutes, or maybe they chose a different book. Okay. They're able to be, you know, quiet and concentrated on their book. So yeah, I like that as a point. Don't give up on it too quickly. Right. So. Well, out of everything we talked about today on the podcast, what's one thing in particular you'd like listeners to remember?
Oh, gosh. I mean, there are so many things, but I think that to remember that childhood is short and it's fleeting. And our children are only young for a very short period of their lives. And I think that society is sending us some really negative messages as parents and educators that we've got to cram so much into their little brains when they're young, where they're not going to go to college and they're not going to be successful. And when you look at many great success stories in the United States or across the globe, not all of those kids were, or all of these people were graded an instrument and played varsity sports and, you know, spoke three languages and were able to do algebra two in eighth grade. I think everyone gets on this treadmill of thinking more is better. And that's not necessarily true. As an educator, I can say, give your child space to enjoy something. Give your child space to develop his or her own talents without you forcing it too much on them. Like, we do need to push our kids to do things, but if they're only doing it for us and they're not doing it for themselves, it's just not going to be sustainable in the long run. And so just, you know, let our kids be kids for a while and let them find their own passions and trust them a little bit to be able to pursue their own interests. I'm not sure we do that enough with our kids. And a lot of the kids that I teach will say to me, like, my parents are on me. I'm so stressed out all the time. And I think, oh gosh, you're 11. Like, you shouldn't be stressed out yet. And so just to relax, our kids, they're going to be okay. Even through this pandemic, honestly, yes, we're seeing gaps in learning. Yes, we're seeing some areas that we're going to have to shore up, but the kids are going to be okay. And it's more important that we love them and care for them and create an environment where they feel safe and where they feel that they can explore themselves. That, as a teacher, I think is the most important thing that we can do. And I hope that parents just sort of hear that and think, oh gosh, good. I can get off the treadmill a little bit. I don't have to be so worried that my child's got to do everything now and be the best at everything now. None of us are great at everything.
No, those are such great points. And I think we all need to remember that and, you know, just let them live, you know, their life and enjoy the moment, like you said, right? Because they'll never be 12 again, right? Well, where can people connect with you and find you online?
Well, my website, which I would like to think is more updated, but they can visit me there. It's melissalowryeducationcoaching.com. So they can find me there. And other than that, I mean, I think I've got contact information on there. And yeah, that's pretty much me. I'm on Instagram, but I don't really do it that much, but I think I'm at Melissa Lowry EDU. So for Melissa Lowry Education, Melissa Lowry EDU. And I put some, you know, little nuggets up there as well, but that's pretty much it. I'm not a huge social media person.
Okay. Well, I'll put that part of the website information on the show notes. Great. And thank you so much for being on the Out of the Trenches podcast today. I learned a lot and we talked about a variety of really interesting topics.
Well, really the pleasure was all mine and I am grateful for the opportunity. So thank you so much.
Check out the show notes on danagoodyear.com to learn more about this guest and links to their social media. Please subscribe, share, rate, and review wherever you download this podcast. Tell your friends and colleagues about it, and if this episode resonates especially with you, be sure to share it out on social media and tag me at Out of Trenches PC.